Good morning and happy Friday, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Defiant Podcast. Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Majid Padelan, a.k.a. Brooklyn Dad Defiant. Monday marked the official start of the Trump hush money trial, and with that, the prosecution's first official witness, David Pecker. Now, sit back for a moment, folks, and get comfortable, because it's story time. Today, it's all about peckers, or rather, a pecker named Pecker. Editors rejoice when seeing this man's name in print for the sole reason that they can write headlines like, Pecker Rises, Pecker Exposed, or as the Daily Beast noted in Wednesday's coverage of the trial, Pecker Deflates. Beyond that, his company, American Media, was hardly a bastion of journalistic excellence. Rather, it was the kind of place you went while waiting for your career to die, a chop shop, the magazine equivalent of Stratton Oakmont from The Wolf of Wall Street. My friends in the industry called it Men's Warehouse for the prevalence of middle-aged white guys from Long Island marching around in ill-fitting suits and bad golf shirts. All of them served at the feet of Pecker, the company's pasha who over the years became a tabloid staple in his own right. With his lacquered hair and porn star mustache, he played the role of magazine kingpin. Holding court in New York's toniest restaurants, he was a Page Six staple. In his earlier days, the former accountant launched the ill-fated George magazine with JFK Jr. But it was at American Media where he built his highly leveraged and debt-ridden empire upon a heap of tabloid trash, manufacturing fake news and engaging in, as he described on the witness stand, checkbook journalism. If there was ever a person literally made for Donald Trump, it was David Pecker. Naturally, the two met at Mar-a-Lago and they began what Pecker described on the witness stand as a, quote, great mutually beneficial relationship, unquote, in which they would boost each other's endeavors, most notably Pecker's National Enquirer and Trump's star-turning TV show, The Apprentice, followed by Celebrity Apprentice. Pecker recalled that his top-selling issues were the ones featuring the reality show Rising Star, who decided the fate of his contestants, elevating some and famously telling others, you're fired. Pecker and Trump became tight. Pecker called him Donald. Pecker recalled telling Trump of an internal AMI poll that showed 80% of National Enquirer readers wanted Trump to run for president. Trump cited the number on the Today Show and suggested he might be running. And then things got even weirder. Pecker was summoned to Trump Tower by then-fixer Michael Cohen and the boss himself, along with Hope Hicks, who was at the time a Trump PR flunky. This began what prosecutors are calling the Trump Tower Conspiracy. You see, Pecker's titles like the National Enquirer and Star specialized in tabloid filth. Having taken down everyone from Tiger Woods to former presidential candidate John Edwards, they also worked the other way. If you were a friend of Pecker's or could somehow be beneficial to him or the company, the Enquirer would protect you. This was known as catch and kill. By Pecker's account, he agreed to be Trump's eyes and ears and alert him through Cohen if he heard of anybody trying to sell negative stories, especially if they were women. Quote, in a presidential campaign, I was the person that thought that a lot of women would come out to sell their stories, Pecker said. Pecker testified that if he heard of any story that might name Trump, he was to call Cohen. They would then engage in catch and kill, buying the story to prevent it from ever being published. Positive Trump stories were embarrassingly sycophantic, reaching levels of hagiography that would have embarrassed a Pravda editor when writing about Joseph Stalin. An early installment, Donald Trump, the man behind the legend, byline Donald Trump, set the tone for all the rest. Bombshell video, Donald Trump was right about 9/11 celebrations. Cruise into victory, Ted endorses Donald. Donald dominates. Trump edges out Clinton in latest poll. And of course, the post-election gloat, sorry pollsters, find out how the National Enquirer predicted President Trump. At the same time, Pecker pledged to run negative stories against Trump's rivals for the Republican nomination. The headlines ranged from bungling surgeon Ben Carson left sponge in patient's brain to family man Marco Rubio's love child stunner to to Ted Cruz shamed by porn star. The Texas senator was also the beneficiary of one of the Enquirer's most storied works of tabloid tall tales with Ted Cruz's father caught with JFK assassin.
Those comments from Donald Trump this morning, more controversy about Ted Cruz's father. Ted Cruz's father and what Trump seemed to be suggesting was some kind of link to Lee Harvey Oswald based on reporting from the National Enquirer.
Pecker would share advanced PDFs of these hit pieces with Cohen, who would offer additional pointers and commentary. But no matter how much mud was slung by Pecker on behalf of Trump, the women continued to come out of the woodwork. It seems that even the most sophisticated sleaze operation in the world could not contain the bad acts and libido of Donald Trump. Pecker testified that he learned in June 2016 that former Playboy playmate Karen McDougal was seeking to sell a story of a nearly year-old affair with Trump.
Former Playboy playmate Karen McDougal appeared on CNN Thursday night to talk about the affair she says she had with Donald Trump before he became president. Among other things, McDougal says he tried to give her money after they had sex.
Unfortunately, the testimony ended on a cliffhanger. But everyone knows what happens next. Like one of Pecker's indecently entertaining stories from The Enquirer, the jury all wanted to know the sleazy details and were hankering for more. Stay tuned, folks. Stay tuned. I'll return with more Pecker tales on Monday's episode, including all the filthy ins and outs of the Stormy Daniels arrangement and the $130,000 payment at the heart of this trial. The question remains, what effect all of this will have on Trump's political standing? A normal person would read Pecker's testimony and see it for what it was, influence peddling and election interference on an industrial scale. In an excellent piece for The Nation, Chris Layman laid it out thusly. Quote, the deep-seated corruption laid out by Pecker establishes a crucial through line in all of Trump's prosecutions and ongoing shakedown efforts. At every turn, Trump seeks to secure perfect impunity through any and all available illicit means. And the moment that anyone privy to those deals turns on him, they are, like Michael Cohen, instantly cast into the outer darkness, designated like the press as the enemy of the people. It's how his great political mentor, Roy Cohn, taught him to move through the world. And it's why Trump will never abide by gag orders, business disclosure laws, or the obstacles thrown in his path by the courts and the press, unquote. And now for the big conversation. My next guest on the Defiant podcast is Reed Galen, a master political operative and founder of the Lincoln Project with more than 20 years' experience. Reed has been involved in politics, government, and business at the highest levels, having served as deputy campaign manager for John McCain's presidential campaign and deputy campaign manager for Arnold Schwarzenegger's successful 2006 re-election campaign. Galen also worked on both of President George W. Bush's campaigns and served the Bush administration at both the U.S. Department of the Treasury and the Department of Homeland Security. As founder of the Lincoln Project, Galen has led the group's vision and created some of its most memorable attacks against Donald Trump. He's now focused on not only ridding the nation of Trump, but attempting to purge the GOP of its love affair with MAGA ideology. He joins me today to read the political tea leaves on what effect the hush money trial will have on Trump's standing. In addition, we'll go deep on the general amnesia folks have on Trump in general, and just how the hell this guy is still a viable political candidate. Let's go to the tape. We'll be right back. Okay, Reed, I want to thank you for joining me here on the Defiant Podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
No, listen, thanks for having me.
I want to first start off by asking you a broad question about where we are as a nation politically. Like the Lincoln Project is entering its second election cycle where we're being asked to, you know, save democracy again. So first of all, you guys need to be commended for, you know, how you came together and stuck your thumbs in the emotional eyes of Donald Trump. I mean, you really got under his skin in a unique way. Like, no, they're not real Republicans. They're rhinos. So let me ask what might be an obvious question. Why Lincoln? Like, why the Lincoln Project?
It's actually really... God, we hadn't thought about that in 4.5 years. It's hard to believe it's been that long. We actually batted around. It was going to be one of two people. We started with Teddy Roosevelt. And we thought, you know, because he was, you know, of his time, right? He was a trust buster. He was, you know, in a different, you know, 120 years ago way, he was a progressive.
He was a rough rider too, wasn't he?
He was a rough rider. Yeah. In fact, that was the official name when we filed the paperwork. And then, you know, we were having a call and, you know, we said, what about Lincoln? And for us, you know, Lincoln was the first Republican president. You know, it's hard to believe now in 2024, but the Republican Party is the last successful new entrant into American party politics that we've had. And it was founded in 1854. And the other part too is it was a single issue party at the time, right? It was against the expansion of slavery out of the southern states and into the Midwest. You know, they ran a candidate in 1856, didn't win. 1860, they run Lincoln. Obviously, we see what happens. The Whigs disappear, right? It split the Whig coalition between northern business owners and southern slaveholders. And for us, it was as much about who Lincoln was and how we saw ourselves, which was, you know, in 2020, 4 years ago, we were invited to go to the Cooper Union, where in New York City, where both of my great uncles attended because they were electrical engineers. The rest of us are all humanities people. But, you know, that was where he gave his right makes might speech that really launched his candidacy in 1860. And to stand at the lectern where he stood and talked about the idea that you could make all the excuses you wanted to for why you were saying what you were saying and behaving the way you were behaving and believing the way you believed didn't make it right. Right. And you could come up with all the excuses in the world. So it's a long way of saying that he was both a historical, a political, and I think a spiritual guide, even to this day, for so many of us.
Would Lincoln be a Republican today?
I don't know that he would be. He was a fascinating man in his own right. And one of those who... you know, many presidents shrink within the job. He only grew within the presidency. And the other part about him was he never lost his sense of where he wanted to go, but he was also perfectly willing to, you know, find different routes to get there, if that makes sense. And I don't want to say compromise because, you know, you can take a step back, you know, to the left to try and go three steps forward. I don't know that he'd be a Republican today. I don't know that he would recognize any of this regardless, but certainly I don't think he would not stand with a party that now stood with, you know, the old Confederacy, right? That holds up the Confederate flag as high as it holds the American flag. And sometimes, in some cases,
I barely recognize it. And I've been following this car wreck the entire time.
Right.
So I recently watched a video that you made. It probably was recent. It was a message to moderate Republicans, and it was very interesting to me because I did want to ask you if you were still a Republican. And what I got from your video is you're not really still a Republican, but you were welcoming fellow former moderate Republicans and you highlighted the Dobbs decision, and you said you probably didn't agree with that decision, and you even highlighted the funding of Ukraine, and you thought, well, that's actually was a good thing. And
right,
it's strange, because as tribal as our politics have become today, those are things that, you know, identify, those two positions would be identified with the Democratic Party. But, you know, in a broader sense, it's not really even Republican or Democrat, those two things. It's just like the difference between what's right and what's wrong.
No, look, first, I should say I am no longer a registered Republican. I have been an independent since early 2016, once it was clear that Donald Trump was going to win the Republican nomination. I said, if this is where the party's gone, count me out. You know, as I've said to others, you know, when I was a kid, I grew up in the GOP, right? I grew up on Capitol Hill. I grew up in campaigns. You could be a Republican. You could be a conservative. You could be a conservative Republican. I was always just a plain old vanilla Republican. I'm not a conservative. I never have been. I don't really like the word moderate, because I think it denotes some sort of, you know, belief, you know, squishiness in your own belief or ideology. I don't think I fit, but that's fine, right? No one is exactly the same anyway. And I think even today, I think the parties have pushed themselves into corners where I think, as we've seen, you know, less and less people identify with them every day. But what I would say is this is, you know, the video I described, you know, this is the difference, I think, between how Republicans wage campaigns and how Democrats wage campaigns. Republicans wage campaigns in narratives and in terms of values, right? What is it that makes you who you are? Or what is it that makes you believe the things you believe? Democrats tend to be much more intellectual about it. Here's this issue. Here's that issue. Here's this issue. Okay, that's fine. But, you know, as you know, politics is an emotional business. And so, like, let's take Dobbs. What's the value proposition in Dobbs? Okay, well, for a soft Republican voter, right, who probably doesn't like Donald Trump anymore, and that could be as much as 30% of the GOP now, right? I mean, just look at the primary results. You don't have to look at polling. Look at how he was doing in primaries. He was consistently losing 15, 20, 25, 30% to Nikki Haley. Even after she dropped out, he was losing 18%.
He was losing 10 points to DeSantis. Yeah.
Right. So he has not consolidated his base. And I think that's not. And so I think that's why he's in real electoral trouble. But back to Dobbs. First and foremost, this is going to sound weird. Republicans consider themselves traditional. Now, here's where I'm going to throw a curveball at you. In the context, and we've done research on this, in the context of America in 2023, when we did a lot of our research, and 2024, Roe v. Wade was a traditional political position, right? That was 50 years old. It wasn't radical. First of all, it wasn't radical when it was decided, and it wasn't radical in 2022, 50 years on.
Settled law.
Yes. And think about this, just as an aside, when Roe v. Wade was decided, the Southern Baptist Convention was supportive of it. Think about that. Right. It was only later in the 70s when they had run out of things to fight, you know, to get their voters fired up, that they decided they were against it. But here's where it is with soft Republicans. First, it was a radical decision to overturn it. Then they didn't like the extremism that came out of it all of a sudden, which was complete bans. No, you know, life of the mother, rape, incest, no exceptions. But here's the other part. What we call Dobbs dads, right? I have two daughters. Do you want the government, or, and here's where you get to Republicans, unelected judges making decisions for you and your family, right? Infringing on your individual liberty. See, I'm not talking about abortion as a right. I'm not talking about abortion as even a medical procedure. But who has the right to tell you and your family, especially your daughters in your home, how they have to do something, what they have to do? And because even a former Republican, we all carry this like libertarian chip around in the back of our head, right? And so individual liberty is iconography. It's iconic. It's the iconography of being a Republican, right? And then you mentioned Ukraine. Ukraine is not funding for Ukraine. Support for Ukraine is not just about bombs and bullets and money, although it is practically about those things. It is about how you see America and America's place in the world and how you see yourself as an American, right? White, suburban, mostly men, right, consider themselves to be proud Americans. They are proud to be Americans, and they believe in America's place in the world. Right? It is a value proposition. Is America the greatest country the world has ever seen? And many of these voters believe, yes, it is. And so when you apply that to Donald Trump being in bed with Vladimir Putin or name your dictator, they don't get it. It doesn't compute. They believe in NATO, right? They believe in the Western alliance. Remember too, that I think it's important that economically, these are all people who have time and the wherewithal.
I'm sorry, when you say they believe in NATO, we are still talking about Republicans, yeah?
These soft Republicans, yes, is an electoral cohort, right? And this is why we're trying to get them across the line to Biden. They also have the economic wherewithal to be able to worry about NATO, right? If you're worried about how you're going to pay your rent or where your next meal's coming from, NATO's not on your list, right? Both of these cohorts tend to be suburban, almost exclusively white, somewhere between 45 and 65 years old. For the Ukraine voters, they remember the Cold War. Maybe Reagan was a hero of theirs. They remember Reagan at the wall saying, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. So, yeah.
So let me ask you this. Are there really that many soft, let's say, you know, quote unquote, soft Republicans, the moderates, the ones that there is a chance for them to carry over? Should my listeners be hopeful that the Lincoln Project can wrangle enough over to our side to make a difference to help reelect President Biden?
Well, I think it's really a two-step process. So the first step is, and remember that this goes back to 2020 as well, is the first thing we're asking these people to do, right, is to stay away from Trump. Don't vote. Don't go back to him. Republicans want to go back to the nest, right? Democrats fall in love. Republicans fall in line. It's an old trope. It tends to work out. The first thing we're asking these people is, look, you voted for him in 2016 because you couldn't vote for Hillary. That's settled law at this point, right, as you put it. 2020, you know, you either voted for Biden or you stayed home. Okay. Let's talk about those voters that might stay home. Remember that in the state of Wisconsin in 2020, 50,000 Republicans who could have pulled the lever for Trump didn't. They voted down the ballot, but they didn't vote for president. I'll take it all day, right? Trump can't survive an undervote. I believe that his coalition now is smaller, older, whiter, more male and more extreme than it certainly was 8 years ago than it is 4 years ago. So he can't afford to lose anybody. So we're finding those folks on the edge of the Republican coalition and saying, we're not asking you to do anything. We're not asking you to violate your political beliefs or your political socialization. All we're asking you to do is not vote for somebody who you already don't like. You know, then once we've gotten them to that way station, the next, and we do a lot of research, which is much smarter than I am. Let's just be clear about that, with people much smarter than I am. And the next step is, okay, now that we've gotten these people off the Republican island, how can we get them from the lifeboat to Joe Biden one more time and say, look, we're not asking you to believe in any crazy progressivism, and understand that, like, I'm not speaking to your voters as crazy progressive. I'm talking to these people, right? We're not asking you to believe in any crazy progressive stuff. We're not asking you to believe in AOC or Bernie Sanders. We're not even asking you to necessarily believe that Joe Biden's the end all be all. What we're saying is Joe Biden is a good person. He's a decent man, right? He's a good American. When he gets up in the morning, right, he's thinking about the best interests of the United States and every man, woman, and child in it. He is not waking up in the morning going, what am I going to wear to court? How am I going to make Putin happy today? What is it that I'm going to do to create outrage such that I keep myself in the middle of the news? We're just asking you to hold your nose, if that's what it takes, and vote for the decent option. Look, and here's the thing. You ask the question about, are there enough? There are enough. And we don't need that many, right? I mean, think about Georgia, 11,000 votes. Arizona with 12,000 votes, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, these are not widespreads. If you can get a percentage of voter Republican voters just to stay home, Biden wins in a walk. If you can convince some of them to stay home and some of them to cross the line for the president, you know, it could be a it could be just a blowout. And here is, just let me end with this, is that Trump's ceiling, electoral ceiling, I believe nationally is somewhere like 46% when it all comes down, when people really start paying attention. Even with, you know, an RFK Jr. or Jill Stein or a Cornel West or whatever, like Trump can't, even with all their help and all the Russians doing, a, you know, all their craziness, Trump only gets to 46, like he loses, right? All the help in the world can't help. He can't fix him at that point. He's not going to be better between now and November. He's going to be worse. And I think we're already seeing this. I don't want to get in to the finer points of Donald Trump's latest court case. All I'm saying is him sitting in that courtroom day in and day out has a material effect on his campaign, because there's only two finite things in a campaign, a candidate's time and money, and they're directly tied to one another. He can't be out in the target states and they don't have the money to be advertising. And it's going to have an effect on his mental state, because he's like, you look at him, he's a caged animal. And so I think that that's, to me, why the court case matters. Not because, I mean, everybody knows he paid off Stormy Daniels. Like, that's not a question. So I don't think individual voters necessarily care one way or the other, but it does have a material effect on his ability to actually run for president.
Yeah. And I do actually do want to, come back to, that whole, the court, the trial that's going on right now. But before I leave this subject here, I wanted to go back to what you said earlier about his shrinking, his steadily shrinking base. And I'll never forget the day that he told Nikki Haley donors, "We don't want you." Mm-hmm. And I was like, holy shit, what is this maniac doing? I mean, like, you know, I'm not a political pro, but, you know, I mean, I saw that and I thought, what a titanic, unforced error. Like, you need to grow. I understand the whole thing. Like, when you're in the primary, you know, that's when you want to tilt all the way, you know, to the far right or far left, you know, to shore up your base. But he was already beyond that. Do you think he's suffering from that shrinkage?
For sure. Well, I mean, shrinkage, I think, has always been a problem for him. But for sure, I think it absolutely has. I mean, look, we're now at least, I don't know the exact day, but we're at least 6 weeks away, 6 weeks past when Nikki Haley got out of the race, right? After Super Tuesday, the first week of March, she hasn't endorsed him. She might never endorse him, right? And so what you're going to have, I think, as this comes on, is will Haley go out and campaign against him? I don't know. I doubt it. If she did, I'd be both impressed, amazed, and appreciative. But those same voters that, you know, that pulled the lever for her are looking for that old style Republican Party. And again, I'm not asking you or any of your listeners to say, oh yeah, no, I get it. I'm saying, like, intellectually, the party of George W. Bush, the party of John McCain, the party of Mitt Romney, I'm not making a value judgment on any of them, although I worked for two of them, is that the old Republican Party they could feel good about. They don't feel good about their party now because they don't feel good about Trump, right? It's enough already. If you have someone like a Liz Cheney, and Adam Kinzinger, or these individual Republican leaders like a Rusty Bowers, the former speaker of the Arizona State House, out there, not necessarily saying vote for Joe Biden, but saying do not vote for Donald Trump. That has a massive, you know, attrition effect, if that's a word or expression, you know, on his ability to get those people. And to your point, he's saying, Nikki Haley donors, I don't want you. And he's telling rhinos, I guess I would still code a rhino as a voter, we don't want you either. Well, where the hell is he going to get his votes? Right? I mean, and so what's going to happen here, I talked to a reporter a few weeks ago, like, they have very smart people in, like, the Christian evangelical movement trying to figure out how many voters they need to get. They need to boast boost, excuse me, white Christian evangelical voter turnout by 7% for Trump to even have a chance. That's their number. Now, you can think they're kooks and they're nuts, and I do, but like Steve Bannon, these people are not dumb. These people are not stupid. We shouldn't underestimate their ability to do math and raise money, right? They have that. But 7% amongst a cohort you were already getting 91% of, right, is really hard math. So what I would say is this is where he's in this rock and a hard place, which is he's got people like I used to be, you know, and I'm going to use left and right because it's the easiest way to describe it, going, I don't really want anything to do with this guy. Some will vote for him because they're Republicans and he's the Republican and there will be a campaign. But on the other side, on his right, he's got MAGA and the Christian nationalists, right? And he can't get too far afield from them because, as you saw with like the Arizona, Supreme Court thing going back to 1864, insanity, right? Trump knows he's in trouble on that issue, just going back to what we were talking about with Dobbs, but he can't get too far out ahead of it. That's why he's like calling on, you know, the governor, a Democratic governor, and the Republicans in the state legislature who have already tanked twice, I think, the ability to try and get rid of this state Supreme Court decision. He knows he's in trouble, but he can't get too far afield because here's the thing about MAGA and the Christian evangelicals. They don't like anybody else. And if they believe that Trump has turned on them, it's not to say all of them will stay home or even most of them will stay home. But if a few of them say, you know what, he's just like the rest of them, I hate the rest of them too, they carve them out too. So he's in a very difficult electoral position. And let's be clear, he put himself there, right? And we should, you know, I think it's important, and I promise I'll shut up after this. All of the bad things that happened to Donald Trump are distinctly and directly because of his own behavior. None of these things happen to him. He does them and he suffers the repercussions, right? He's not a victim. He's the victimizer.
So I literally just saw him about 10 minutes ago. He just left court and he was bitching and whining about, it's kind of funny. I did revel a little bit in his sorrow, but he's complaining that, you know, he's stuck in court all day long while Joe Biden is out there campaigning, and really it's his own goddamn fault.
Right.
I wonder if his appearance over the past week of falling asleep in court, right, and farting and, you know, the whining stuff, the veneer of invincibility, of alphaness, seems to be failing him right now. It's buffering right now. What do you think that does to his base with him no matter what, no matter how weak and sappy he appears?
Look, you are making a brilliant point, and a brilliant point when it comes to the leaders of authoritarian movements. And you just hit the nail on the head. When their invincibility is pierced, it's only a matter of time, you know, to use a bad balloon analogy, whether or not the balloon pops all at once or it's a slow leak. Either way, the balloon empties out. I think you're absolutely right. Look, again, I don't think most voters, you know, really care one way or the other. This is, again, sort of a settled case, you know, in some ways, like he did these things. But falling asleep, why does falling asleep matter? Okay, it makes Democrats happy because it makes them look old and enfeebled and everything else. And he is those things.
But he also was battering Joe Biden with the whole Sleepy Joe thing.
Right. That's exactly my point. So it takes away that strategic pillar of his campaign of saying Biden's not up for the job. Then, you know, you've got the farting thing, which again is more ridicule. But then he was complaining, I don't know if it was today or yesterday, about how the courtroom is freezing. Okay, well, somebody get Papa a cardigan, right? Like, right? Somebody get him a knit, you know, a blanket to put over his lap so his legs don't get cold, right? And so, and then it's just, you know, like, if you've ever been to like a museum or any kind of, you know, thing where there's a lot of information being, you know, there's only so much. It's like you get the first 45 minutes and then your brain's full. And after on minute 46, who knows what the hell you looked at, right? Unless it was like the Mona Lisa. And then it was sort of like, oh, I saw the Mona Lisa. But, you know, how much of this, like for Trump supporters, hardcore Trump supporters, or even sort of marginal Trump supporters, like how much more of the bitching and moaning do they have, you know, capacity for before it's like, it just sort of bounces up because the cellular wall is full. There's no more opportunity for the stuff to get in. And so, you know, I used this expression and I decided I used the wrong singer, right? At first I said, like, he's like Frank Sinatra singing the hits. He's not Frank Sinatra. He's more like Mel Torme, or take any old crooner, right? They can't hit the notes anymore. They sing less songs every tour, right? Because they can only remember the words, and, you know, people want to hear the hits. Well, Trump, like, can't hit the hit. You know, he doesn't have anything new. There's nothing new for his people. And here is where he was always at his best, and he was brilliant in his time. He could always shock, right? He was going to put on the show. He was going to say and do things no one had ever had. And he's still doing those things, but he's so far on the edge now, he's got to talk about vermin, right? And, you know, and use all these hallmarks, you know, linguistically of, you know, fascists and Hitler and authoritarians, you know, the world around. So, you know, it's, so, and then you have more Republicans like I used to be doing what I'll call, actually my neighbor turned me on to this, called the mirror test. You got to look at yourself in the mirror and say, is this the guy I want to sit at the table with? And I think there's going to be more and more, you know, voters, whether or not they're Republicans or conservative leaning independents or people who just sort of, you know, anti-establishment, who are like, I want somebody to shake it up, going, ugh, it's enough already.
Is that enough? Speaking of enough, sure. But is the contrast of his overall shittiness enough to overcome the perception of Joe Biden's age? Because really, I mean, that appears to me to be the biggest complaint that I hear. And I'm sorry, he can't not be old. Sure. You know, he is who he is, you know. And but is the juxtaposition of Donald Trump's 91 felony counts and his January 6th thing and his extremism and fascism, right, is all of that horrible enough to make folks that we're trying to peel away, you know, pull the lever for President Biden?
You know, so here's what I would say is I interviewed a guy named Mondale Jackson last week for the Lincoln Project podcast. And I think the interview just dropped today. And he's from Enfield, North Carolina. He's mayor there. He's born and raised there. And he said something really interesting. It really depends on the voter or the group of voters. So, you know, he runs something called the Black Men's Voter Project, registering African-American men. And he said, don't come to me with how bad Trump is. Right. I get it. We get it. Right. The question is not going to be whether or not Donald Trump is bad, but what does Joe Biden represent and what does his presidency represent going forward? And I think that's a really important question. And I think it's an important question that the president himself will have to continue to look at, and his campaign and his administration will have to make account for, which is, we all know Trump's an asshole. That's not new news. Like, I used to call this the discount rate, which was the difference between how a candidate was perceived and when something bad happened. You know, what was the distance? Trump's been a terrible human being in public for 50 frickin' years, right? There's no, like, all of the stuff that he does, again, is not a surprise because he's always been terrible. So now Biden has to say, it's not enough for Joe Biden to say, you know, yes, democracy matters. And with a lot of voters, that will matter. But it's more going to be if again, in probably so many of the listeners you have and so many of the communities you know, if democracy has never worked for you, is democracy going to be the issue that gets you to the polls? And I would venture to say the answer is no. So then what's the case you're making for a Joe Biden presidency? It's not enough. Look, it might be enough to make it simply a referendum on Trump. It very well might be. But if you are the president of the United States and you have the White House and all of the assets of the federal government and a couple of billion dollars, why wouldn't you spend some time talking about what comes next, right? Because here's what I would say, and you can make this about Trump if you want, or you can make it about Joe Biden if you, I think is a better idea, is if you care about the things you care about, name your issue, the environment, unemployment for minority communities, right? Which with, you know, in Mondale's neighborhood, 18% unemployment for black men in the county he lives in, right? That's unbelievable. He asked
that's,
me if
that's high.
Yeah.
That's higher than the national average, because right, the national average is down around 5%, I
right.
think.
And if look, if the unemployment rate was 18% for white guys, would there be blood in the streets?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It'd be a cataclysm. But so you have the opportunity to make the case for the future, which I know sounds ironic because it's Joe Biden. So it's got to be about what Joe Biden is for, not necessarily about who Joe Biden is, because I think that's also inculcated. He is he's old, but he's also fundamentally decent, right? I mean, think about it. Joe Biden's family likes to spend time around him, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump can't get family members to show up to his court dates, right? And so I think it has to be about not transactional in nature. And again, this goes back to the idea of the difference between values and policy. What are the values that Joe Biden espouses? And why is that better for America than what Donald Trump espouses? Because again, if you care about the environment, if you care about jobs, if you care about healthcare, all those things are only, we can't even have those arguments with Donald Trump as president because he doesn't
right.
care.
Right.
Right. They're only possible with Biden back in the White House.
I'll tell you what, when you ask what does Joe Biden care about, I go back to what he goes back to almost every time, like mm-hmm. his sweet spot. He likes to talk about how he sat at the table with his dad when he was young, and his dad said, "Don't worry, honey, everything is going to be all right."
Right.
You know, and I go back to, like, he is that guy that reaches you, you know, if you're a father, if you're trying to reassure your family that everything is going to be all right, even though things are kind of tight. Like, he's that guy. He's the guy who took the Amtrak, that took the train every day right. to work, even though he didn't have to.
Right.
So I think the way he packages himself is just as Joe, you know? Like, he's just that guy who gives a shit about whether or not you're able to afford putting food on your table and, you know, pay your electric bill. And, you know, he's passed a lot of things that have helped the American people, like with the insulin thing being capped at $35 a month. That hits me. You know, I just learned last year that I'm diabetic. So that is a thing that hits my wallet and I'm very grateful for. I want to ask you about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. because I don't have access to polls and data. And I know, you know, it depends on who you're asking, who you're calling, and what polling company is doing the work. And I try to stay away from polls as much as possible because I don't want to freak out too early, you know. But I've seen some polls that worry me a little bit. You know, they show like a head-to-head, Biden against Trump Biden is okay, just head-to-head. But when you break it into a three-way race and you throw RFK Jr. in there, that kind of muddies the picture a little bit. Should we be concernicus about RFK Jr.'s involvement? Who is he pulling from? Is he pulling from Biden? Is he pulling from Trump? What's the deal?
So a couple of things. I think he probably is pulling a little bit evenly right now. But I think a lot of that is name ID. I think some of it might be younger voters who, you know, have been told that he's really good on the environment. It might be what I call Marin County moms, right? Or maybe Goop moms, right? They're the people who have believed for 20 years that autism is caused by vaccines when there's absolutely no evidence to support that. Right. They tend to be wealthy. They tend to be white, but they also tend to congregate like in Malibu, right? Like, it's not, there's not a lot of them probably in suburban Milwaukee. There might be a few, but not a ton. So I think that he has, you know, there's a lot, look, a lot of Americans are unhappy with the idea that they're getting Biden and Trump again. I get it, right? If I had my druthers, like, we'd have, we'd be in a different place altogether, but we're not. I think that, and I wrote about this on my Substack, The Home Front, you can find it, is that I think that that Kennedy ultimately hurts Trump more. He is a Trump plant. I firmly believe that. Now, I don't have evidence of phone calls or emails or anything like that, but there's enough pictures of him with people like Roger Stone and Steve Bannon. It's like, yeah, okay. That his belief system does not align with the Democratic Party of today. And it doesn't align with most otherwise normal human beings. It aligns almost perfectly with Donald Trump. Actually, it's even in some ways wackier than Donald Trump. He's anti-vax, right? He's, he's pro-Russia, or at least, you know, he's not pro-Ukraine. He loves conspiracy theories. He said, you know, crazy things about the Jews and the Chinese being immune from, and here's where, he talked about, he said he thinks he wants to put the American budget, the U.S. budget, the federal budget on blockchain. Now, I don't even know what that means, right? But here's what I know. You know who the only people are that care about the blockchain? Like, a bunch of crypto fascist weirdos. Normal human beings, like, don't know what that is. I know more about it because I've read about it, but I'm also not a normal human being. I spend too much time doing this crap. So, like, I think that, and then there's another cohort that I think could be very damaging to Trump. And they're what I call the FU white guy. They're my friends. They are suburban, white, educated, upper income. Their kids, if they're at home, go to good schools or private schools. If they're not in the house, they go to college. They're successful. Life has been good to them. They saw having to get vaccinated as the civil rights crisis of their time. It was the first time in their lives, no shit, was the first time in their lives where they'd ever had to do something they didn't want to do because somebody told them they had to, right? They probably voted for Trump in 16. Maybe they even voted for him in 20, but they've always known he's a goon. They've always known I don't want to say he's an idiot. I mean, he's not an intellectual, but he's intelligent in his own sort of lizard-like way. But Kennedy gives them an off-ramp. They don't like Biden, because he's establishment, and you know, he's pro CDC, and you know, they don't like Ukraine, they don't like Russia, but they think Ukraine's, you know, these are guys, I don't know if you've ever heard it, they listen to this All In podcast by these tech Silicon Valley guys. They're all worth a gajillion dollars. They talk about their whiskey collections and getting married and Italian villas, right? Like, it's all like, and I can't even say that, I can't even use the expression on your airwaves because it's not family friendly. But the point is, it's a circle jerk, right? It's mental masturbation. And they want, like, they have everything in the world, but they want that next level up. But it also causes them to hate everybody. And I have a lot of friends like this, right? Which is really disappointing on several levels. And so I think that there's this big group of white guys who won't vote for Biden, who might have voted for Trump. But if they decide they can't vote for Trump and Kennedy's still around, which I think is only a 50-50 proposition, then I think they could go to Kennedy. And these are not voters that Biden was ever going to get anyway, right? So that's a long, long way of saying, I think at the end of the day, Kennedy hurts Trump more. And you're already starting to see this, right? Which is, I think Trump even said, I think he might hurt both of us equally. There's a lot of Trump donors who are going to Kennedy. And I know the guys and the gals that run Trump's campaign. I think this is one of those where they had this grand idea. And like so many things, once the monster got out of the cage, it just went and did what it was going to do. And here's the other part. And I've heard this from on very good authority. Kennedy never would have run for president, but for the fact that Trump did and won. Because as I understand it, earlier in life, he always had these aspirations, but given his checkered past, never thought he could get away with it. But once Trump got elected, he's like, yeah, what the hell, right? Anybody could be president, literally at this point. So yeah, that's a long way of saying so they probably wanted him as a stalking horse to peel Democrats off. I think it won't be surprising if you see the Trump people start to go after him in a pretty big hurry, because again, is if you believe that his ceiling, if Trump's ceiling is 46 and it goes to 44 because Kennedy takes 8% of the net general election vote and 6% of it comes out of Trump, that crushes Trump. And the longer Bobby goes into this, and let's say, and it may be really nerdy for you, let's say he picks up Secret Service protection. What does that mean? Okay, well, he's got guys and gals with guns around him. You also get a motorcade. You get the trappings of power. That's something I've seen it up close. Like, I've lived this. Those candidates, they love it. Who wouldn't, right? You're transported around in a limousine and you've got an SUV with guys full of guns behind you. You've got cops and lights and sirens and all this, you know, hail and fury and everything else. And I think he'd be like, I'm not giving this up. I don't care what Trump says. So I think, you know, if he makes it to November, I think my gut says that he'll hurt Trump more.
So you said if he makes it, you think there's a chance that he might pull out?
I say that only because here's the other part, too, is, you know, Kennedy is resilient. He's been through a lot. He's done a lot, both to himself and to others over the years. Here he is. He's still got some residual magnetism for people, but he's never been tested like this. There's a great book by a guy named Richard Ben Kramer called What It Takes, about the 1988 campaign. It gives you a sense of how long Joe Biden's been around. Joe Biden is a big part of this book. And ultimately, what it takes is the ability to withstand things that no one else can withstand, and the willingness to do the thing to win the other guy won't. And I think that Kennedy might have the willingness to do the thing the other guy won't. We haven't seen whether or not he can withstand things that other people can't. And that's really, it's a gauntlet. It's the most trying political task humanity's ever created. It's not combat. It's not torture. It's not prison. It is a very long slog. And, you know, we're a long way, you know, in some ways, you know, the election will be here tomorrow. But if you're that candidate day in and day out, it is a long slog. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not he and his, you know, unknown VP candidate are prepared to deal with what's going to come their way, because there will be no punches pulled from either side. Ultimately, both the Democrats and the Republicans will do everything they can to destroy them.
And I'm frankly confused, because he's not even on the ballot in a bunch of states. Like, he doesn't. What is it? I don't even get what his end game is, aside from trying to deny President Biden the number of electoral votes that he needs to get to 270. Outside of that, what else is he playing for, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
He can't win a plurality. Yeah. So but anyway, speaking of nutcases, let me switch gears briefly and jump on to Tucker Carlson's most recent appearance on Joe Rogan's podcast, where he asserted that the theory of evolution has been proven false, and that, you know, supernatural beings in the ocean are killing people. Do you think he's just lost his mind at this point and believes the nonsense that he spews, or does he know what he's saying is total bullshit, but he has a captive audience who, you know, just loves conspiracy and just catering towards his audience? What is up with Tucker Carlson? He's not a dummy.
I think he is, to use an old literary reference, I think he is Alice and has stepped through the looking glass into Wonderland. And I think he lives there full time. I mean, this is also a guy who thinks that, like, tanning your balls is like a good thing, right? Like, this is somehow healthy. So I think he's lost it. I think he's completely lost it. I think that, you know, this is, I mean, who's with it, who goes to Russia to interview Vladimir Putin, right, through whatever channels he had to get that done, and then has Vladimir Putin bat him around like, you know, a sick puppy for half an hour, right? And then comes home and says what a great thing it is. I mean, I just, look, there's this story. So Rupert Murdoch, right, he owns Fox News, owns News Corp, was engaged to this woman. And I don't remember her name, and I think it was sometime last year. So he invites, I think this is before he fired Carlson. So he invites Carlson out to dinner, you know, at his home with his fiance, and his fiance and Carlson are talking about all sorts of like really strange, esoteric, very fringy Catholic stuff. And it so freaked out Murdoch that Murdoch broke off the engagement. He's like, I'm not doing that. I think he has crossed over 100%. I don't think it's an act anymore. I think he really believes it.
There was some talk about I don't know how true this was, but there was some talk about the possibility of Tucker Carlson being Donald Trump's running mate. How likely do you think that is?
Zero. I mean, Carlson's too big a name in his own right, and he would. Either by accident or on purpose, do things that would outshine Trump, and Trump can't have that.
Mm. Would you say the same thing applies to, hypothetically, is there a possibility that RFK Jr. might team up with Trump as his running mate? Since he seems to be, you know, ideologically more aligned with Trump than with Biden.
Sure, I could see it. I mean, I don't think it's likely, but I could absolutely see it. If there's one thing Trump likes, it's famous people and fancy names and all that. And certainly Kennedy has that. And I think that Bobby is probably, self-loathing enough to be able, you know, be willing to bow down to Trump at every occasion, because that'll be a necessary thing. I could see it. Sure. But I don't think it's likely. But yeah, I mean, whoever it's going to be, we should always remember, whoever it's going to be has to accept the fact that Trump tried to kill the last guy with the job. Right? I mean, come on. Like, really? That's the job you want? Okay.
You really do seem to have your finger on the pulse of what's happening. I want to pick your brain. I want to see, sure, who do you think is his most likely vice presidential candidate?
Well, you know, for a long time I thought it would be Kristi Noem from like South Dakota, right? She's now gone full magnified as far as her look is concerned. She's got the hair extensions. She's got the giant teeth. She's got the fingernails. She's got the toucan. And that's just aesthetic. And he likes that stuff, right? That's sort of what he's looking for. He also would fire up the base. She would fire up the base. The problem is that what they're seeing is, you know, you saw that they're desperate to try and figure out how to get somebody on the ticket that sort of softens the whole abortion piece. And she certainly isn't going to do that. And frankly, again, I'm not sure who they could choose at this point who's going to do that. I mean, if he were a different candidate, he would have said, you know, Nikki Haley and I had a really rough primary, which they really didn't, but I'm going to choose her. I'm not sure she would do it. And B, I'm not sure he could ever choose her. Or would choose her, because, you know, she's already been willing to cross him in such a public way. Again, it would be a smart move, but I'm not sure Haley could go along with all the craziness that he said in good conscience. Now, maybe she has no conscience. I don't think she is either. I'm glad to see that she took him on. Her level of spine remains to be seen, but again, it could be, you know, I think they want a woman. Some people said Tim Scott. Like, what has Tim Scott get you? I'm not sure much of anything. You're going to win South Carolina. And let's be clear, even if at the basest level, vice presidents, you know, don't matter. People vote on the presidency. And people say, oh, you know, they're going to vote on, you know, Kamala Harris. No, they're not. No, they're not. You know, they're going to vote on whether or not they want Joe Biden or Bob Kennedy or Donald Trump, not who's going to be vice president.
Yeah, Tim Scott is actually doing a really good impersonation of Mike Pence you know, in the way he gazes adoringly at his orange emperor.
I mean, you have to think about this. I mean, what does it say that you're willing to put up with that kind of ritual humiliation? I mean, I just don't get it, right? I'm glad I don't have that chip. I got to be honest with you.
It's when you talk about this humiliation, that is the one thing that has puzzled me. That, you know, a while back we were all saying that that he's got pictures or video on these guys, like Lindsey Graham, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, Lindsey Graham called him a racist, xenophobic bigot. And, mm-hmm. you know, and go all the way down the list. Each one of them had fire for him. And now they're all just like poodles, you know, subservient poodles.
Yeah. I mean, for someone like Graham, it's a survival mechanism. You know, he wants to be closest to the brightest star he could. That for him was John McCain. And so when John McCain was alive, God rest his soul, that was who Graham gravitated to, right? And Graham parroted a lot of what McCain said. You know, Senator McCain gets a brain tumor, he's passing on. Graham says, okay, who's the next person who can keep me in the spotlight? I think for others, you know, the Tom Cottons of the world and the Josh Hawleys of the world and the Ted Cruzes of the world and the Elise Stefanik's, I think they're somewhere between Graham and Carlson. J.D. Vance is another one. They're not in survival mode because they're unlikely to lose whatever seats they have, but they haven't yet completely crossed over, although I think every day they're getting closer to it, because some of the things you say and do, they're saying and doing, you just can't come back from. Now I could be wrong, right? There's lots of second acts in politics. But they're also looking forward to a post-Trump time when, you know, the majority of the party will still be more aligned with MAGA than it will be with the party I grew up in. So, you know, I think that, you know, they're willing to put up with a lot because they figure, well, even if Trump wins, like, is he going to make it through a whole term? You know, if he doesn't make it through a whole term, who's that? You know, J.D. Vance would love to be vice president. You know, and then I'm set up for 2028. Let me be clear. Like, I think if Trump wins the presidency and is alive in 2028, there ain't going to be a 2028, at least not the way you and I have ever thought of it. And so I think that there's a lot, the party is in his thrall. The majority of it is. I mean, look at the states, you know, look at the states, you know, whether or not it's Idaho or Utah where I live, or Wyoming, the Dakotas, the old Confederacy, the people that are in charge there are not old school Republicans. They're not moderate Republicans. They are not country club Republicans. They are full on ultra MAGA.
Reed, let me ask you, Do those party leaders, do any of them confide in you? Do any of them like pull you to the side and say, Reed, I got to tell you, honestly, this guy's bad shit nuts. The fact that you're so heavily involved with the Lincoln Project right now, do they confide in you at all, or are you the enemy?
No, they wouldn't throw water on me if I was on fire. Yeah, and that's where the world is now, right? I mean, the interesting part is we've been against him since from the get-go, and in the weird authoritarian mindset, we're the enemy, but we're still like the first tier of people who they hate the most are those that betrayed them, right? So anybody who worked for him, who's now come out against him, right? Anybody who testified at the January 6th hearings or will ultimately testify whenever the Jack Smith trial, probably a lot of the same people, they're tier one, because betrayal is the ultimate sin. We've always been the enemy, right? That doesn't mean they don't hate us, right? And it doesn't mean that if Donald Trump got reelected, it wouldn't be a pretty bad day for a lot of us, or a bad 4 years or however long it would be. But yeah, it's the people who were with him, who are now against him. They're at the top of the list, and then it sort of rolls on from there. But look, eventually, you know, these people get around to everybody. And I will say this, when a Donald Trump type, and it's really important to understand the people around him. Again, they are not stupid. They have plans for this stuff. They will move very, very fast to consolidate stuff to their advantage, because they know that if they don't, whatever guardrails are left will try and hold, will do their best organically to hold out as long as they can. So they will come in with, you know, axes and flamethrowers to knock down anything they can as soon as they can.
Yeah. If Donald Trump gets, God forbid, if he gets reelected, I'm sure by now you've seen that Project 2025
yes. mm-hmm.
Thing. It's terrifying to think about. You know, that could be the end of our democracy if he gets back in, because it's that thing is all about him consolidating power mm-hmm. and ensuring his, you know, his retribution, his revenge against those who have wronged him.
Yeah, look, Project 2025 at its core is this. It's to destroy the parts of the federal government that help people and embolden and enlarge the parts of government that can control people.
Hmm.
I mean, that's it. You know, what they call the power ministries, Department of Justice, the intelligence services, the FBI, Homeland Security, any place that's got information on people, jails and guns. Like, those are the guys that are going to get all the money and all the attention. And that's where the craziest of the crazy will end up.
Have you had any luck or had any traction as far as sounding the alarm on that Project 2025?
You know, it's a good question. I have so much homework left to do on this. I have some friends who are working on it, who are doing a really in-depth review of everything, and they have done some incredible work. So, you know, once that gets done, yeah. And I also, I want to get it out of Project 2025. I want to call it Trump 2.0. Right. Because Project 2025 gives it this sort of like veneer of legitimacy. Exactly. I was like, no. This is not the Heritage Foundation. This is like what Trump and his people are going to do. Right. You know, they want to change the name of the Department of Health and Human Services to the Department of Life. Right. Like they're going to gut the Environmental Protection Agency. They want to get rid of NOAA, the weather people. Right. Like, why would you get rid of the weather people? I don't like, and this is where it crosses from scary to crazy. Like, what? Like, you're going to get rid of the weather people? And it very well could be because he's still pissed off that, like, he got ridiculed for, you know, putting the, yeah, exactly. Like, that's entirely possible.
He tried to Sharpie the hurricane.
Alabama, because yeah. He wanted it to go to Alabama and it wasn't going to Alabama. Like, that's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of insane, Marjorie Taylor Greene, mm-hmm. Just want to get your opinion on her. Is she just a sideshow that's just passing through, or is she a harbinger?
I think it could be.
is she a sign of the look of the Republican Party for the future? Is she have staying power?
Yes. It depends. I mean, if Trump wins, for sure. If he loses, in the short term, yes. I mean, she's in a hyper gerrymandered district, so she's unlikely to lose mm-hmm. anytime soon. But her ability to, you know, sit there and throw bombs at, you know, let's be clear, like Mike Johnson is speaker, like he's no moderate, right? He's a wacky right wing Christian nationalist evangelical, and she's throwing bombs at him. And so, you know, her desire is to be in the middle of things. She has no interest in governance. She has no interest in the good of the people. Her interest is in, you know, being as ultra MAGA as you can be. And as I've said this before to others, I'll say it to you too. We have to remember that inside MAGA, the only people they hate more than you and me are each other, right? It is a cutthroat world. They would all climb over one another. They'd all step on each other's necks in half a second if they thought it would get them one rung up whatever ladder they're all climbing, right? Which is that closer to Trump, closer to money, power. It's all a gang, right? That's all this is. It's gang tactics. Money, power, territory, self-aggrandizement. That's all it is.
Reed, I want to ask you about projects that you are working on. You know, you said you have a Substack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, look, I mean, I have what the Lincoln Project podcast comes out twice a week. So, you know, like I interview a lot of authors, a lot of experts on authoritarianism, You know, we do some straight political stuff. What's the horse race look like? I have my Substack. It's called The Home Front. It's where, I, you know, a couple, three times a week, I try and explain, you know, why something's happening. I've been doing this a long time, a lot longer than I can imagine. Sometimes it's more sort of philosophical. Sometimes it's sort of rah-rah cheerleading. And then look, you know, most of the focus, you know, for this year will be really for me in four states, Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, you know, with those same types of voters that we started talking about at the top. If we can win those or keep enough of those folks from participating for, on Trump's behalf, then we win and we all win. And so what I would say is this is, you know, if you can get off the couch, if you are interested, you know, get involved. It doesn't have to be with the Lincoln Project or anybody else, just somebody in your community. There are a ton of groups out there who are doing incredible work, whether or not that's in get out the vote operations and voter registration, voter communication. Most of them, you know, are understaffed, underpaid, punch well above their weight. Again, you know, it's not, there's going to be 160 million people that vote, and it's going to be, you know, we happy few, hundreds of thousands, maybe a couple of million who are in there in the trenches day in and day out making stuff happen. And if you are willing to, you know, pick up that shovel and dig alongside us, right? Like, we'll take all the help we can get.
Reed, thank you so much. What are the 2 days that your podcast drops?
It's usually Mondays and Wednesdays, but it's, you know, go to, you can find it wherever, you know, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever your fine podcasts are found.
And do they just type in the Lincoln Project?
Lincoln Project Podcast. You'll find it right there.
You're such a knowledgeable guy, and I really appreciate, I can't tell you how much I appreciate what you guys do. Your videos always make me laugh. They are hilarious. They're biting. And I think that ultimately the key to hurting Donald Trump is the ridicule, is the humiliation. That's the key. So please keep it up. And Reed Galen, thank you again so much for joining me here on the Defiant Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have today on the Defiant Podcast. But I want to leave you with this essential nugget. What we're hearing from the Trump hush money trial is a lot more than how Donald Trump used a major media outlet to influence an election. It also speaks volumes about Donald Trump and who he is and what he's about. His world is one that's defined by back-scratching sleaze with Trump at the center, acting as a de facto mob boss. That's really the only way to understand the man. To think this man is some kind of martyr or political hero is absurd. He's compared himself to both Jesus and Nelson Mandela, but in reality, he's closer to John Gotti. Unfortunately, even that description Trump would enjoy. The fact of the matter is that Trump has no code and shows no loyalty. Mobsters would spit on him. But this is the man millions believe is fit for the highest office of the land. I'm terrified beyond measure to how we got to this point and where we go from here. Thanks for listening. Stay defiant.